From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The price of insulin is soaring, and some patients are rationing their dosage, risking death. With millions of Americans living with diabetes, what can be done to help patients afford this essential drug? Hopkins internist and medical historian Dr. Jeremy Green describes how innovation has upped the effectiveness of insulin in the 100 years since it was discovered, but that's come at a steep price.
Why we have continuously transitioned our insulin market to the newest possible form while allowing these older things to just fall out of use entirely, it's hard to say that we're better off by not having a generic insulin market.
Plus, the Maryland chapter of the American Diabetes Association details free local resources for diabetes management and support. All on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. What do you do when cost puts a life-saving drug out of reach? More than 30 million U.S. adults are living with diabetes, and millions more are at risk for developing the disease. Many must choose between their medication and other essential expenses. The price of insulin has skyrocketed. A 2016 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that the drug's price tripled between 2002 and 2013. A Yale University study of diabetic patients in Connecticut found that one out of four admitted to using less insulin than prescribed because of the cost. That is dangerous. Dr. Jeremy Green is an internist and a professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's also the Elizabeth Tridy and A. McGee Harvey Chair of the History of Medicine and author of the book Generic: The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Jeremy, welcome to On the Record.
Thanks so much, Sheila. It's delightful to be here.
So what have you learned from patients about the cost of insulin?
Well, it really surprised me. This is something that came out of clinical experience. We've been taught in my medical school and residency that insulin is a very difficult drug to take, and there are many reasons why people living with diabetes can have a hard time hitting their target of glucose control with insulin. You know, it's a needle. The medicine requires storage. There's complicated schedules. And you can imagine if you're someone who's working two to three jobs and has an irregular schedule, the ability to comply with the demands of insulin can be challenging. But we had never been taught that the cost of insulin should themselves be prohibitive to managing diabetes. I mean, insulin, after all, was discovered in 1921. It was first patented in 1923.
Almost 100 years ago.
Almost 100 years ago. It is, in some ways, one of the first of the major wonder drugs of the North American pharmaceutical industry, really tackling a disease, type 1 diabetes in particular, that previously had been almost universally fatal, and making it into a long-term manageable chronic condition as long as you have a supply of this medicine. And so when I started seeing patients in my clinic, really this decade, who, when asked why they were having a hard time managing their diabetes, said, well, the insulin costs too much. The first response is, well, clearly we just have you on the wrong insulin. You might be on a newer insulin or in a fancier device, and let's get you back to generic insulin, because surely that exists and must be very cheap. And I started calling around pharmacies in the Baltimore area and realized that there was no generic insulin. There were three brand name manufacturers of insulin, and all insulin in the United States, this is in 2015, was available through one of these three brand name manufacturers. And this struck me as a real challenge. I started asking around other colleagues in internal medicine, primary care physicians, endocrinologists, and nobody had really been paying attention to this. Most other doctors that I talked to said, no, there's got to be a cheap form of insulin available. It's this old drug. Let's just use the older version. And as a historian writing a book on generic drugs, I was also blindsided by this. It didn't occur to me that there could be no generic insulin. And yet there was. My patients, when they told me that they were rationing in their insulin or that they had missed buying a vial in a month, when they came in with blood sugar values high enough to really require hospitalization, they were telling me very clearly, insulin price has become a problem. And the question was, why?
Type 1 and type 2 diabetes, what's the difference?
So type 1 diabetes is the inability of the body to produce enough insulin to manage the blood sugar management of the body. So insulin is a hormone that is circulates, is produced from the pancreas, from islet cells. And if you lack the ability to produce enough of it, then your blood sugar levels will escalate. It causes a dramatic number of other complications and really leads quickly to premature death. Type 1 diabetes is often called juvenile onset diabetes because people develop symptoms oftentimes in childhood and then prior to the invention of insulin did not live much longer past that. Type 2 diabetes, often called adult onset diabetes, occurs when the cells in the body begin to be less responsive to insulin for a variety of possible reasons. And so in type 2 diabetes, you can also become insulin dependent if your pancreas keeps on cranking up more and more insulin to have the same response of managing your blood sugar, to the point where people with type 2 diabetes can have their pancreases burn out as well, at which point they also require insulin for management. Many people think that type 2 diabetes is a behavioral disease associated with obesity or poor life choices. And I think this is a real mistake that is made often in suggesting that people with type 1 diabetes require insulin to live, but people with type 2 don't. Many people with type 2 diabetes also require insulin to live.
And if you don't get enough insulin when you need it, what happens?
If you're an insulin dependent diabetic and you can't have a reliable supply of insulin, you die. If you require insulin and you ration your insulin so that you can stretch it out and have it last longer and you're treating yourself suboptimally, we see a higher rate of complication. We're talking literally loss of life and limb.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Jeremy Green, an internist and professor at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We're talking about how patients have been affected by the soaring cost of insulin. So why isn't there a generic version of insulin?
Yeah. This is a mystery to me, and it's a mystery that I've looked into with some colleagues here at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere. We look back at the history of insulin because insulin is one drug, but it's also many drugs. And so if you go back and look at the original insulins that are produced in the 1920s, this is out of the group in Toronto that wins the Nobel Prize, they're using extracts, animal extracts. So there's pork extracts. You can come out of the pancreases of pigs. There's beef extracts. And for a while, these—
From the pancreas of cows.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so for a while, the insulin market is an animal biologics market, and they purify it. These are short-acting drugs. Just around the time that the first insulin patent is expiring, and that's a patent which, by the way, is sold by these researchers at the University of Toronto to Eli Lilly for $1. And the patent is egregiously sold for $1 so that the pharmaceutical company can help maintain reliable, high-quality insulin in North America and around the world.
At an affordable price,
yeah. What begins to happen after the patent on these initial insulins runs out, we see a wave of new insulins develop. Some are developed by the company that becomes Novo Nordisk, something called neutral protamine hagedorn, or NPH. And this is a way of taking this insulin and suspending it in a matrix so that it lasts longer in the body and has a longer duration of action. And you might imagine this both helps people with diabetes manage their illness better. It's more convenient and more effective. And so NPH is an innovation. There's a new patent there. It's a new drug. We see roughly around the time that that patent is expiring, other newer developments in the insulin market, insulin products that are less antigenic. So these are all animal compounds, and they produce allergic responses in some people with diabetes. And there are new methods for making that happen less often. There are also new ways of producing different profiles of how the insulin is released in the body. And what you see when you look at the history of insulin products is a wave of different products that are always seemingly emerging just about when the patent life of the prior generation is expiring. By the time you reach the end of the 70s, Humulin, this is Eli Lilly's drug made from recombinant DNA. It's human insulin that is produced in tissue culture, right? So this is the first major drug of the biotech era. And eventually we see almost all of the animal insulins fall out of use and all insulins become human insulins. Right when the patent's expiring on Humulin, there's a new crop called analog insulins, and they take human insulin and they tweak it just a little bit to make it longer lasting or shorter lasting. And this is where we get drugs like Lantus or Humulog. The patents on that last generation of analog insulins just expired within the past 5 years or so. And so we see a wave of patents that stretch from the 1920s to the early 21st century, but in which there's always some insulin under patent.
Do these different generations of insulin actually make an improvement? Are they worth the patent?
Yeah. I want to emphasize that I think all of these are significant innovations. So there's a critique of me-too drugs that pharmaceutical, brand-name pharmaceutical manufacturers can find a way of transitioning a market from an on-patent drug into a just subtly tweaked version of their drug and maintaining high prices while forestalling generic competition. In the case of insulin, there is a real innovation happening at each of these junctures, but an innovation which surprisingly has caused an almost complete transition of diabetes management always towards the vanguard of care. And this is the problem that I don't think has been discussed enough, which is that while if I was a person living with diabetes in the year 2019, I would be most interested in having available 21st century biotech insulin, if that is an unaffordable drug, there is still a value to these older versions of insulin. And so this calculus of why we have continuously transitioned our insulin market to the newest possible form while allowing these older things to just fall out of use entirely, it's hard to say that we're better off by not having a generic insulin market.
Last May, you testified in front of the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging at a hearing about the cost of insulin. What actions did you recommend to them?
Well, I think the United States Congress has a responsibility to shine a light on the problems of drug pricing that are otherwise opaque to American patients, physicians, and consumers. In the case of the insulin market, we know that prices have increased dramatically. We don't know why. We know that the brand name pharmaceutical industry, manufacturers who produce insulin products say, well, the prices increase because the list price is a fabrication and they need to elevate that list price. Because in the complex chain of steps between manufacturer and consumer in American pharmaceuticals, there are many middlemen that take cuts along the way. And so truly the list price that they set is artificially inflated so that the discounters, pharmacy benefit managers, for example, these entities that help produce volume discounts for HMOs and pharmacy chains and hospitals, can take their cut. So the brand name manufacturers say, we're not the problem. We're trying to make insulin affordable. The problem are these middlemen. The pharmacy benefit manufacturers will in turn say, well, we're not the problem. We're providing value to the American consumer. The problem are these drug companies that have these very high-priced drugs. Now, one of the problems we have is that both of these parties can accuse each other of actually being the lesion in the system, but neither of them have to disclose how they actually negotiate their prices, which is to say how much profit they're really making in this process. And in a perverse way, it's in the interest of both parties to keep these prices high because they make more money off of them, and to keep the details of these price negotiations a secret from American taxpayers and American consumers. So I think that until there is a bright light shone upon these pricing practices, we are not going to learn anymore and we're not going to make any progress. So my recommendation to Congress is to subpoena that information, to use the function of Congress, which acts as a public clearinghouse of vital information for American consumers, to understand what is actually going on in insulin pricing so that it can be fixed. Because everyone agrees that it is a market failure. Something is going terribly wrong, but the parties involved have no incentive to fix it on their own.
A lot to think about. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Dr. Jeremy Green is an internist and professor at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Quick break here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, supporting and celebrating those with diabetes, we hear about the local work of the American Diabetes Association. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. One out of every eight people in Maryland is living with diabetes, more than 600,000 people. About one-fourth of them don't know it, and many more are on the verge of developing diabetes, specifically type 2 diabetes, which often occurs when your body can't make enough insulin to keep your blood glucose at normal levels. David McShay is executive director of the American Diabetes Association Maryland chapter. The American Diabetes Association advocates for the prevention and cure of diabetes. It fundraises for diabetes research and does educational outreach. David McShay, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much for having me.
Who is most at risk for developing diabetes?
Well, the reality is that unfortunately everyone's at risk for developing diabetes. Right now in America, we have 30 million Americans who have diabetes. But if you think about that as sort of the tip of the iceberg, there's the underneath the water that we can't necessarily see. There's 86 million Americans that have prediabetes, which means their blood sugar levels aren't quite what makes them diabetic, but at the same time, they are at a high risk for diabetes. So that's about a third of our population.
Okay, and why that third and not the other two-thirds?
Well, there's a number of factors that go into whether or not you're at risk for diabetes. One of them is lifestyle. So what you eat, how often you exercise definitely contributes to that. And unfortunately, a lot of our habits as Americans over the past several decades have contributed to the great growth in diabetes and prediabetes. Sedentary lifestyle, unhealthy eating habits, the fast food allure that's very easy and quick and cheap to eat fast food definitely contributes to the growing diabetes epidemic.
And why should we worry about it?
Well, ultimately, it comes down to complications. Complications of diabetes come from everything from a blindness, kidney failure, heart attack, heart disease, stroke, and ultimately death. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't see diabetes as an urgent disease. They think, oh, you can take pills or you take insulin and you'll be fine. But the reality is that if you don't tightly manage your diabetes, you're at a much higher risk for one of those complications later in life.
How can it be that such a big proportion of people who have diabetes don't know it?
Well, it's very interesting. A lot of times the way people find out, unfortunately, is when they end up in the emergency room with a complication or with a blood sugar level that is exceedingly high. We often hear that story. Someone is feeling really sick. They're tired. They may be urinating a lot. They may have really intense thirst.
Those are all symptoms.
Absolutely. And eventually they may end up in the hospital, and that's how they discover they have diabetes. Someone does a blood sugar test and they say, you know, you have 700, 800, 900 score in your blood glucose, you have diabetes, and here's how you manage it.
How does the American Diabetes Association work to spread awareness about prevention and managing diabetes?
In a number of ways. One of our big calls to action is to take our diabetes risk test. It's a one-minute online assessment that asks you some very simple questions about your heredity, your height, weight, exercise, lifestyle. And through that quick test, you can determine if you're at a higher risk. So for instance, because I have diabetes in my family, I'm automatically at a higher risk for having diabetes. And so if people do just that, and anyone listening who might wonder if they're at risk, go on to diabetes.org, take that test, and if you score high, you should go see your doctor and get a blood glucose test.
And we will link to that from our website. What else?
Additionally, we do a lot in the community around education. So a couple examples would be we do diabetes self-management education, which really helps specifically people with type 2 diabetes learn how to improve their eating habits and nutrition. Right now, we're doing a program with St. Clair Medical Outreach Center in Lutherville, and it's actually bilingual. It's called What Can I Eat? And that's the number one question we get from people with diabetes when they got diagnosed. Well, what can I eat? So this program teaches them how to make better choices, how to prepare foods in a healthy way, how to really be smart when you're eating out so that you're eating healthy food. And ultimately, that's one piece of the puzzle that helps them better manage their diabetes.
Many people may start off a new year with resolutions to eat less sugar, eat fewer carbs. Are there some general guidelines from the American Diabetes Association on nutrition?
So our position is that we don't ascribe to a very specific diet. We would recommend that people consult with their nutritionist or their doctor to choose one that's best for them. But I think overall, we are really focused on building a healthy plate. And that's really crucial for us. Portion size is something that unfortunately in America has really gotten out of control over the past few decades. And so we really try to focus on the largest portion on your plate should be vegetables, fruits and vegetables, lean meats and proteins. And the good news is that the ADA has a lot of resources around this.
If you go Tell me about that.
So one of our newest tools that we developed that's free for all people, not just people with diabetes, but maybe those at risk, is called Diabetes Food Hub. And it's a meal planning tool online. Very advanced and very easy to use. It has a ton of recipes, almost 1,000 recipes that we've developed with nutritional information. And basically what it does is it presents you with grocery lists once you choose your which meals you want to prepare. And it also learns what you like. So it starts making recommendations based on the things that you like. So super intuitive tool to sort of take out the guesswork of what are healthy meals that I should be eating.
That's David McShay, Executive Director of the Maryland Chapter of the American Diabetes Association, located in Baltimore. We're talking about the signs of diabetes and ways to manage it. There are several local support and education groups organized by the American Diabetes Association. What are those groups for?
So I mentioned the What Can I Eat program that we have with St. Clair Medical Outreach.
And you said it's bilingual, Spanish and
it
English.
It is. And that goes the entire year, so through all of 2019, it's currently funded. And it's made up of small cohorts. And the great thing about small cohorts of 10 to 15 people is that there's shared accountability. And it helps them help each other on changing their behaviors and what they eat and how they prepare their foods. And so we're really excited about that. Another program that we have in Frederick, Maryland currently is called Project Power. And we're doing it in conjunction with the Boys and Girls Club of Frederick. This is really a program that's geared towards children who are at risk for type 2 diabetes. Years ago, type 2 diabetes used to be referred to as adult onset. And we can't even call it that anymore because so many children, due to our lifestyle, our American lifestyle, sedentary, not eating well, now many children are at risk for getting type 2 much earlier, which means they're going to get complications much earlier. So essentially, it teaches these kids how to, early on in their lives, make healthy choices so that they form these habits early. And as they grow up, they'll carry them with them into adulthood and hopefully stave off getting diabetes. The great thing about the program and what makes it unique is that there's a portion of it that's geared towards the children. There's a portion of it that's geared toward the parents of those children. And there's a portion of it that's done together. So it really brings the family together and teaches them how to live healthy and make better nutritional choices.
When the weather warms up, there is the Tour de Cure at Goucher College. Tell us about the Tour de Cure.
Yeah, so we're very excited about that. Tour de Cure at Goucher is in its second year at that location. We had a great time last year. We had about 500 participants. It's actually a run, walk, ride. So whether you want to hop on your bike and do an easy 12 miles or you're a serious cyclist who wants to do a 63-mile route, we have one of those for you as well. We have a 5K run and we have a walkathon. So there's no reason not to bring out the whole family. It's a fun day with a great after party with food and craft beer, and just a chance for us to really raise awareness about the cause. Again, you know, create a sense of urgency. But ultimately, everything we talked about does depend on our ability to fundraise. And so we appreciate people being able to reach out to their friends and family and encourage them to donate to their efforts.
Thanks for this overview.
Absolutely. Thanks. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
David McShay is Executive Director of the Maryland Chapter of the American Diabetes Association. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have links to the association's risk assessment, as well as information about local support groups and the registration for June's Tour to Cure. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.